still doing that Radio 4 shit.
I just can't seem to think of anything else, you know.
No, it's sad, isn't it? We can't think of a good...
What about if I did it with a different sound?
All right, try it with that. It's a bit quiet.
Children's TV of the 1970s.
Yeah. Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Indelicates Live Jukebox Podcast. Let's see what Julia and Simon have got in their special house today. It's a bunch of children that they have tied up. Now then. Oh, we haven't got. We have got someone who is of the north, though. So it's just like the 70s, isn't it?
It is very much like the 70s.
It's B.
It's our friend B. I can give you a
he's
little
He's not just our friend, though. He's also brilliant at stuff, which is why he's here.
He's the former head of anti-workist propaganda at the Inactivist International, and now he's the current member of the FARQ, and he's a Berlin DJ.
Yeah. 1, 2, 3, 4! Yeah.
I did sort of do that, didn't I?
Yeah, it's good.
Some people should be seen and not heard. Or whatever it is she says.
Yeah.
Some people.
I thought that was a good recording we did of Alan Moore's version of, you know...
You're not the completely secret thing you're not allowed to mention in public in any way in case you'll get sued.
Fuck. Edit point.
Indeed.
Yeah, it's fine. Oh, this has all gone really badly wrong already. But I'm not editing it. That's the rule. Okay. It's not really the rule. I have edited it secretly. I've edited other things because we've gone off on directions which we've later considered to be deeply offensive to our core listenership. And cut
problematic.
Them out. Yeah, very problematic. Actually, we've been saying problematic a lot on the podcast. You've been listening to the podcast.
I have.
But you've only heard up to like, because there's been, I think we've recorded 3 since then. So okay. Our memes have all evolved.
Very good.
And we don't say problematic anymore.
That's
so last week.
I still haven't come up with any good segments for a little while I was doing my segments.
Well, yeah. I was thoroughly enjoying the teenage poetry.
Really?
Let's bring it back.
Okay. All right. Well, it's a bit early for a segment. We haven't had any other chit-chat yet.
Yeah, but, to be honest, we've done that thing again where we have the person come like an hour before we start recording and say most of what we were intending to say.
Indeed. Although,
and I know that B doesn't like to explain his work. So that's going to be difficult.
Explain my. I don't know how to explain my work. I mean, let alone. I don't understand that.
But you do all kinds. But you are. You're someone who has written manifestos. Has been in excellent bands. Is currently sitting there with a laptop.
Yeah.
A poet. Do you still call yourself a poet in any sense?
I do.
You do.
I do.
Really?
I do. Yeah. Well, I still write poetry. So.
I kind of want to kick sand at you.
Yeah. Well, I see. There's a problem with poetry. Essentially, it's a dead form.
But
it's only a dead form for the white English, really.
Okay.
I mean,
which you are.
Yeah, which I am.
Yeah.
But you know, I mean, I'm quite into, you know, zombies and the whole, you know, corpse poetry and all this kind of thing.
Yeah.
Where you know, I'm resurrecting a dead form for the purpose of kicking it rather than.
Okay. Oh, I see. So So zombie poetry, define zombie poetry for the people at home.
The people at home. The zombie. Well, it's not really. It's not really a definable thing. It's just these. It's like it's an idea. There's the. I did a song called "Living Dead Boy," which is like in zombie drag, which is this whole, like, you know, it's this sort of gothic, like aging gothic feeling where you're too old to look like a goth, but you're still doing it because you've got nothing else, and the whole thing is just crumbling, and the ideas that you held on to are basically in the past, and you try and bring them back, raise them back to life or whatever, and they turn out all dysfunctional and disjointed, and you have, you know, it's somewhere in there is Frankenstein as well, because there's the whole, like, well, you have to hack and slash and put back together, and you get your monster and it doesn't work. It's this crappy piece of dysfunctional, disjointed shit. But you do it anyway because you have no idea what else you're gonna do or what else you can do. I mean, this is where I am. I mean, it's like I'm trying to bring, you know, daft ideas and I don't remember anything anymore. And I barely remember names and I'm like, so I'm constantly struggling for little bits of things that I used to know. You know, saying, well, this is something I used to know. And
so, would you find a bunch of poetic references and things that have been in the history of poetry and then kind of cram them together in like a found way?
No,
or is it something you are writing? It's like it's a obviously this isn't the only thing you do, but like, it is like original writing, but it,
it's original writing, but it's sort of, it's from a position where I know it's already dead.
Yeah.
If you know what I mean. So it's like, I don't...
Yeah, okay.
You know, it's not... It's the most irrelevant form.
Because I got stuck into that. I started when I... Towards the end of my career as a poet. Uh-huh. I like to use the word career because of bitter irony.
Well, I don't know. I think career is a very good word. I mean, yeah. Is it really, you know, to go out of control and essentially off the cliff?
I think it counts as a career. I got paid £100 once to support John Cooper Clarke.
That's
he
a
got
career.
Paid £1,000.
Yeah.
Oh, dear.
Yeah. But that counts as a career because I did get paid £100 and it was in a castle. And I got, but towards the end of it, well, just before I kind of really stopped writing poetry forever and took to.
You didn't forever, we've written here and there's.
Yeah, occasionally, but really the idea of being someone who considers themselves a poet kind of. I was just writing things deliberately about nothing.
Yeah.
Which is something that Alex Velke does as well now. He's got a whole section in his book called Poems About Nothing.
It's very good.
But I had that in there. But I had that, and then I was just, because I was trying to write poems about, like, because, like, you know, like Martin Creed with the artist with the, where he just kind of makes art which unmakes itself, and I got really into that idea. So like the poem that by the end of the poem everything it's stated has been negated by the poem itself, so that what you're left with is nothing at all.
Yeah.
And that seemed to be the only thing I could do in poetry, and then I kind of did that and stopped.
Yeah.
I like to think of my poetry career as a oscillating waveform that is of increasingly of ever decreasing, what's it called, the height of the wave in the waveform.
The amplitude.
Yeah, the amplitude. So it's an oscillating waveform of ever decreasing amplitude, which finally tapers off into zero. That is how I view my poetry. What form of waveform or quantum superposition do you view your poetry career as?
I don't have a poetry career, but no, I mean,
what? Neither do I. But you said I had to use career.
I didn't say
you can't get out of it now.
Yeah, no,
I'm calling it a career. I've paid you money to read poetry for me before.
True.
So it counts as a career.
Yeah, I don't know. I think it's like, I started writing poetry because I wanted to, like, I had shit to say, and then I realised the shit I had to say was rubbish, and then I carried on writing because I couldn't do anything else, and at some point it began to make sense, and for a short period I wrote with a sense that I was writing something that made sense, and then, like, 5 years later I looked at it all and I was like, this is nonsense. And you know, and now it's like, now I'm in that position where I just think, well, I don't really know anything, you know, I don't have that certainty anymore at all. I think, you know, so many things are just like peripheral fragments of knowledge that I have, and nothing's whole or complete. Yeah. And it's like, and you know, I kind of observe the world as I observe it through my myopic lenses, like not really grasping anything, but still feeling the desperate need to and like, and it is a need.
Yeah.
It's not like something I
can't leave it, can you?
No,
won't leave it. Just can't leave it alone.
No, it's like, you know the tune "Leave It Yeah" by oh god, who's it by? Can't remember. Oh Jesus, it's a memory. Lethal Bizzle, I think.
Okay,
it is.
Yeah, right.
Leave it, yeah.
So, but you think, I know you've got a very broad spectrum of things you could be drawing from, so I don't want to. It could be grime from the last 5 years, or it could be, yeah, it could be, you know, something that Alfred Jarry said.
Yeah, that's true.
I definitely have less.
I don't think actually "Leave It Yeah" could have been something.
No,
collection since you moved to Berlin. I have less interesting things to listen to.
Yeah.
Selfish, really, moving to Berlin.
Yeah, completely, entirely selfish.
I really
mainly just listen to Keane and Coldplay now. It's just awful.
I actually know from previous listening experience that you mainly listen to Martin Denny at the moment.
I do.
Yeah.
And Les Baxter.
I just listen to hard trance.
And Sissy Mobley.
It's sort of like a drug listening to hard trance. Well, because it is obviously like a drug, but like in the sense that I've got my TuneIn radio app and I have lots of choices and things, and I almost always just click on the hard trance one just because I don't really want anything to listen to. I just want something that goes exactly.
No, I mean I
it saddens me that they don't exist. I don't know, I think that was a very interesting period. of music history, dance music.
Well, it's kind of weird because I don't know if you saw, there's a thing in Vice recently about psytrance,
right?
Like, and that was just really bizarre. Like, because there's some like person who is not into psytrance goes to a psytrance night and he just describes
yeah,
it. And
I
it's
think
like,
I did read that book.
And it's just so strange. You just yeah, this is it's like a niche of experience that. I mean, I remember from taking psychedelics and basically going dancing, but it's so like the like it's so become its own self-perpetuating thing, and you know, like all subgenres do, you know, they just go off and live somewhere.
That's
and
right.
You can visit them if you want, and it's a bit like going to a museum, but it's slightly more living than a museum. It's more, it does change, and people do, you know, it's not as frozen, say, as a mod night or a, you know, any of the revivalist nights. I mean, psytrance is a living form.
You can throw in a grind beat or something in there without people having too much problem.
Well, I keep going
it.
On about this City Bounce at the moment. I'm a bit obsessed with City Bounce.
Yeah.
Just because it's such a like narrow but totally extreme queer thing that's come from like really poor, desperate communities in New Orleans, like you know, from the worst projects in New Orleans, and there is this like aggressively queer thing that's coming. A new Sissy Novi single is amazing. My boyfriend is better than yours. Amazing. Right, I shouldn't do the voice, but you have to really. It's fucking awesome. It's almost unlistenable, but it's fucking brilliant. And it's just like this like screaming guy, just with all these women around him shaking their asses that he's not interested in.
Yeah.
It's just, I don't know. I can't quite get my head around how good it is. It's interesting because you've been in the Brighton Museum ever.
Yes,
because we went in there recently, and they've kind of had this whole exhibit about like clubbing up at Ditchling Beacon in like you know, free parties and shit.
Okay,
in
the
90s, and you were sat there listening to a like you know one of these little telephones that you pick up, and you can listen to a woman just going, "Yeah, we were totally mashed." I thought it was brilliant, man. It was really good. It was right in the museum.
I was cool. Nodding along.
There were like you know flyers from the Pussycat Club and stuff like an exhibit.
I thought that was a really interesting thing to do. I actually thought that's what they ought to be doing at places like Mass Observation at Sussex University, because it's like, you know, you're ending up with lots of stuff that people want to give you, but actually not a lot of stuff that people are forgetting to give you. And it was really cool.
Because there's that problem with Mass Observation, and it's supposed to be the history of the real people, but it's actually a history of a certain kind of hobbyist, middle-aged man.
Well,
and people in the future will look at Mass Observation and go, wow, everyone's really into like hill walking in the 21st century. It's like that's really the only person who contributes to it.
Well, it's always the same though, isn't it? It's the, you know, I mean, that historical narratives and their editing.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, the people in the future will think that the 80s is exactly how it has been described in the I Love the 80s / the alternative versions of this, what the BBC4 documentaries about music and stuff, and you're just like, but it's really still incredibly partial, and certainly if you're outside of say the cities, your experience of you know, it's all slightly received and very distorted, and you have these like songs will come along at the same time and they're completely disconnected, but you'll connect them because you're where you are at that time.
Yeah.
You know, and I mean, this is the thing.
Or you put them next to each other on a mixtape.
Yeah.
Because there's songs which I like indelibly link together, one naturally leads into the other in my mind, that are only because I once thought, oh, I'll put that CD on next.
Yeah.
I had Sinatra next to Hard Chance.
Bet that works.
Well, it sort of does. You get your big build up, your big peaks, and your big orgasm, and then you get this sort of gentle.
Wicked witchcraft.
Yeah.
Good.
Speak singing.
So do you want me to read one of my poems I wrote when I was 13?
I think that'd be good. That ties into everything we've been discussing rather neatly.
Poetry is shit. To conclude this.
I meant the bridge thing. not the shit thing.
I've got one I wrote in February 1995 when I was 12, 13. And it's called The Music. And it's rubbish, so don't like
it. No, because last time it was all right, the poem, wasn't it?
Yeah, but that's the reason the segment wasn't... Yeah, you thought it was all right. I didn't think it was all
well,
right.
Well, let's see.
It flows, it weeps, it sidles and creeps. Its notes are smooth, but jump and leap. It plays a tune so sad and dead, and by its notes it's slowly read. The tune sings out, all full of pain. The tune stops short, then plays again. And as it springs to life, it speaks. It tortures life, one only seeks. And then a chord, an ending life, a murder with a bending knife, a scream that sounded like a trill. It sounded even louder still, and quietened when the piece was ending. Was it murdering or defending?
It's all right, isn't it?
It's not bad. It's all right.
It's about a killer fishmonger.
Who the fuck knows?
Well, they're the ones with the bending knife.
Yeah, the boning knife.
Yeah.
I mean, it's got form. It's got relatively...
Is it about a killer fish monkey?
It's called The Music. I don't know. It's probably about like me looking at a piece of paper and going, oh, I could write about notes on a page. Wow.
That's good.
That'd be amazing. And dark.
You're a very talented young woman. You should go to that Oxford. Go on the X Factor or something, do that.
Oh yeah, the X Factor.
You should send that to the parish newsletter. Is that advice that you still get? Because I remember when I was a kid, the advice you always got when you'd say, oh yeah, I've written something, they go, you know what you should do? You should send that to the parish newsletter. Where do kids send poems now if they live in parishes?
Does anybody live in a parish anymore?
And New Orleans, that probably doesn't count, does it?
No, I don't think it's a parish.
I think there's definitely a parish council where my parents live.
I think there are still parishes, but does anybody live in them?
Yeah, but children.
I mean, do children... Because to live in a parish, it means to be actively engaged in the community.
Oh, I see, you mean live, not just live.
Not just live.
Not just exist.
No. Yeah. To actually live in the parish, to actually...
It's because of Thatcher, in it.
It could be because of that, but no, I think it's not. I think it's more perfectly because religion has successfully alienated everybody, which I think is a really good thing.
I got into trouble for liking the film.
Which film?
The Thatcher film.
You should get into trouble for liking the Thatcher film.
I shouldn't get into trouble. I just thought it was a good film about dementia. I work in a care home.
There are many other ways we could have good films.
I mean, I thought there was... things wrong with it, definitely, but I didn't think it was like a bad film. Well, I got into trouble for it.
It's probably not a bad film, but it's a film I will never watch. I mean, that's just like the level of what's the word, bile, incoherent white boiling rage that I get whenever she comes in within the sort of passing distance of my fucking senses. Yeah, no, I
think I was a little bit too young, though. I remember Spitting Image and stuff, and I remember joining in because my parents joined in, but that's not my politics, and so it's not something I'm really connected to.
I remember playing a game, right, where I had a little action toy and another little action toy, and one of them was Scargill and one of them was Kinnock, and I had them fighting each other.
Really?
That definitely happened. It was quite current in my house with Union in that, but like, I was like, ah, Q, Alta Scargill. You've got to get a second ballot, you bastard. I'm not doing that.
That's kind of weird. Really
to be honest, it wasn't that advanced.
No, well.
I like to think that it was, but it wasn't. It was just in the news a lot, and that was the news that was on.
Yeah.
Thatcher didn't come into it though, didn't she? Wasn't part of my game. It was just Scargill and Kinnock going at it.
Yeah, she was unfortunately part of my game. I mean, she was, you know, in that way, like, you know, she was part of my chanting childhood because I was of an age where she could snatch my milk. So, you know, even before she was the Prime Minister, sure it existed.
She invented the ice cream with the milk, didn't she? Took it away and made a certain kind of ice cream with it. But I think that's not true. Someone said it. Did someone say that on the podcast? That
I don't know. Someone said it in conversation to us the other day.
Because I think precisely what ice creams were and were not invented by Margaret Thatcher is, I think, the real question here. Uh-huh. And because there is some suggestion that she invented the Mr. Whippy, but I don't think that's true. And some suggestion she invented various other ice creams. But I need to look that up, really, before I talk about it.
Yeah.
Should we have some music?
Oh, must we?
Yes. Music. Do we have to?
Well, what kind of music? Music from us or music from B?
What would you rather?
Music from you.
All right.
Yeah. All right. So, what is the latest in our litany of despicable requests?
Well, we're going to run out of the really awful ones,
and we're into the list of things that we actually quite want to play.
Ones that we want to play soon. So,
I think we did run out of the really awful ones. We definitely hit bottom a few weeks ago.
Yeah, we did.
With the worst possible request anyone could have requested
for Kim Kroll. We are going to play something, even anything, from The Land of Oz. And I think he or she means the Book of Job.
Not just Iraqi folk music.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah, exactly. You don't know any of that.
From the fictional Land of Oz, as created in my musical, the Book of Job musical, rather than the actual Land of Oz, which I think is largely in Iraq now. I think so.
Yeah.
Land of Oz, if anyone knows the land of, exactly where the Land of Oz, that would be really useful. Yeah. I can point. We could both got pretty good pinpointing Damascus on a map.
Yeah.
Did you play the game where you...
No, I wouldn't. No, I have no idea where Damascus is.
I did do all right. I was 40 miles away, but it was on a phone. So I think if it had been on the computer, right, because I know where it is, and so I was like, but, you know, I think I've got fat fingers and I was pressing an iPhone. But, like, I reckon I could have got...
Yeah.
It was pretty good.
My geography is...
It's opposite Greece.
Well, yeah, my geography is intolerably bad.
It's obvious you can find Greece, because it's the one with all the bits.
That would involve...
When you start looking at the Middle East, it does blow your mind. Because, like, you can't... All the things, all the places you've heard of aren't... Like, Africa is next to the Middle East.
Yeah, yeah.
And so it actually makes no sense at all to call it the Middle East. It's kind of this ridiculous sort of terminology to describe
it.
Well,
Syria in Lebanon didn't used to be the Middle East. They used to be the Levant, the Mediterranean countries of, you know, people that eat olives and sit outside and... Take their houses,
just call it
stuff,
the middle, I suppose.
And then it became the Middle East when they all started having wars. Yeah. Especially Lebanon. Lebanon was not considered a Middle Eastern country at all until they started having wars.
But you look at the map.
It was moved in the popular
imagination. Greece is there. What?
Yeah. Well,
I always think Austria is way further. Like,
yeah,
Vienna
totally,
is really, really far east.
Yeah. So in order to get around it, you need to go through the Czech Republic, you know, which we try not to do.
I know it's sort of south. It's south of. Where I am, isn't it? That's basically that's how I know it's sort of it's south and a bit west, isn't it?
But well, Vienna, like if you like leave Berlin, go off through Poland, and then for quite a way into like Eastern Europe, and then go south, you go to Vienna. Like it's really far.
My geography is shocking. Apart from like an in-depth knowledge of the A roads and motorways of the British Isles, which I got from Hitchin, I have very like that's how I learned most things, was by going on a road and finding my way from A to B by a process of catching lifts.
Never hitched. I think that's something my parents hitched a lot. I think it's
my
just something that's changed.
Too, but I think it definitely has changed. It's not.
When
really
did it change then? When was it the case that you couldn't really? I suppose you still can kind of.
Mid 90s, I'd say. Probably that's
when
the
was
latest.
Last time I hitched to London from here would have been, at the end of the 90s.
I hitched mid 90s back from a rave.
I know people who still hitch, but it's a lot less common. And the car sharing, car sharing websites that exist, what happens is people now expect to be paid something towards the petrol, so they don't pick people up in the same way, and if they do they're kind of iffy if you don't, and so it's the whole thing. It's like it's damaged hitching culture. And then the other part of it is, of course, as private lorry drivers die out, like business lorry drivers who drive for companies are not insured to carry passengers, and therefore they won't pick you up.
And the petrol price probably makes a difference too.
Well, it shouldn't make any difference, because it doesn't make any difference whether there's someone in the cab or not.
I suppose.
No, it's really. It's all to do with insurance, generally. Like a private driver has his own insurance, so then he can do what he likes.
Okay.
Because I keep seeing Widowson lorries driving around, which is just the name of the company is Widowson. Right. Are they Masonic lorries?
I have no idea, probably.
Because like it says Widow's Son right on the side of the lorry, right? And I've never met anyone whose name is Mr. Widowson, right? They're Masonic, I don't know what they've got in those fucking lorries, but it's not right. Just loads of eyes in pyramids, that's all they've got in there. And, relics from Jacques de Molay. So what do you want me to
sing? I think we're going to sing Satan from
really?
The Book of
Job. Really?
Because
how will that work? Because we need six demons.
I'm
going to
be the demons.
How does it go, do you remember? I have to work out how it goes.
That was the right one, I think.
And then it goes... La, 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 la. Yeah, that's pretty much how it goes.
We can do that.
Yeah, fine, all right. And you're going to be all the demons?
Yeah, I've done this before.
Okay.
Several times.
All right, so just for anyone who
I read the little bit of narration beforehand?
In a minute, I'll explain what it is first.
Okay.
So I wrote this musical based on the Book of Job. Because I thought if it was going to be like an Andrew Lloyd Webber style biblical musical, it had to be one of the ones beginning with J, which literally that was the actual thought process. And Job was one of the few that was left, and Jonah would have been a bit short and impossible to stage without some kind of big fish.
Yeah. Giant whale experience.
Yeah, plus he doesn't really learn much apart from don't get in a whale. it's not a very good lesson.
No.
Whereas Job, he learns the fact of what fucking life is like. But in it, I put there's Satan, who's one of the main characters who I play in it, and this is the song introducing him.
Act 1, Scene 5.
Oh, yeah, and in it, right, the narration is like all the stage directions describing what would be happening if there was a budget, a part of the action. So it's very good. It's available on Corporate Records. First half is free, second half costs money, so spend me some of that.
Spend me some of that.
Yeah, it's a new thing I'm saying.
Okay. Act 1, Scene 5. Hell, a cavern of red rock the entire height of the stage. Midgets in full demon costume push force perspective treadmills at the rear of the action. A fully animatronic Sisyphus pushes his stone endlessly up a slope set stage right. There is a terrific amount of fire from torches, ovens, and most of all from a fully realised lake of flame in the centre of the stage. Satan's six principal demons enter at a run as they shout their introductory lines. They are costumed in deep ruby cloaks of finest velvet, wear astonishingly realistic makeup, and are a truly horrific sight. Who's the man who's the original rebel? And who's the man who leads the unholy rebels? Who's the guy who's never on the level? Who's the guy who gets the witches to dabble? Who's the one who rouses the rabble? Who can't bring himself to ever be civil? Ladies and gentlemen, present the devil!
I gave you war, I gave you famine, I gave you pulpits, I gave you Indiana, I gave you fear, I gave you pride, I gave your girl a funny feeling deep inside. I gave Mussolini his stature, I gave you AIDS, and then I gave you Margaret Thatcher. I gave you nuclear bombs, petrol plant cons. This is the devil coming at ya. Yes, I'm Satan.
Satan!
Read it in Patton, up in Eve, runes that I'm Satan.
Satan!
God damn if I don't have the best tunes.
Who's the guy who made Vanessa put the weight on?
Not really topical anymore, is it?
And who's the man who set up Angus Dayton?
Really, really not topical anymore.
Who's responsible for West Drayton?
That will always be topical.
Who never even tried to blag his mate? Who's an influence on Simon Clayton?
Still very not topical.
Who gave the secrets to the Masons? Ladies and gents, may we present
SARS. This dates it, doesn't it? What is the current scare for things now?
Swine flu.
I was doing bird flu, then swine flu, but now really everyone's fine, aren't they? What's the current flu? H6N7? I don't know. I gave you whatever the current medical scare is. I gave it rainy. I didn't gay it rainy. I made it rainy. Okay, no, we're going to... This is fine. This is fine. I gave you whatever the current medical scare is. I made it rainy. I gave you former Vice President Cheney. I gave you fear. I gave you pain. The last savage sat up saying,
hey!
I gave
Lorna Luke and his au pair. I gave you Major, then I gave you Tony Blair, then Gordon Brown, and then David Cameron. I gave you chemical weapons.
And interesting, now that's topical again. Interestingly enough, Angela Rippon. See, that was always a placeholder, that.
Yeah, sort of.
But, you know, I've never gone back to change it. It's like, there were, you know, like Lara and Note to Follow So. Every year they must have gone, oh, why did we let that get through? But I've left Angela Rippon in.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know.
Yeah, interestingly enough.
Morecambe and Wise, isn't it?
Yeah, it is, basically. This is the devil, and he's tripping. That doesn't even work.
Yeah, Satan.
Satan!
Read it in the pattern of evil runes, and I'm Satan.
Satan!
And goddamn if I don't have the best tunes. I'm the man with the plan, and the plan is evil. The guy with the life of the stupid little people. The dude on the news doing something illegal. The thug with the drugs and the HIV needle. I'm the one and only, first and foremost, original rebel. I might be an angel, now fuck it, I'm the devil.
Thank you very much. Yeah, that's all right, isn't it? I'm gonna have to, when we revive it next time, I'm gonna have to rewrite all the words.
We did come up with some, but they're all on the script.
So. There's words, but the bits, there's a line there that we always just, we try and make topical each time. But what's in the news? It's one of those times where the news is a bit serious.
Yeah.
And you sort of go, oh, I can't really.
No.
Not effective. Not
it would be Jimmy Savile, I suppose, but that's past.
Yeah. Oh, well, we'll get a sort of Savile Devil. That's perfect, isn't it? We'll get that in first yeah. next time. Maybe we'll do another one from that later.
Okay.
And I'll try and do it properly.
All right. Rolf Harris.
Rolf Harris. But Harris, you.
Though
to be honest, this won't go out for at least a month, so he could have been found entirely guilt free by then.
Well, he won't.
No, he won't.
is he supposed to have been?
He's been charged.
This is
that thing though, isn't it? The conflation between what we used to call underage sex or statutory rape and paedophilia.
Like, yeah, I reckon we should get into the sort of pro-pedo argument on this.
I don't think that'll go down at all. Yeah.
I always thought, you know what podcast I'd like to do?
Edit point.
When we get someone from Nambla, we'll discuss it. You guys, well, you know, it's fine in ancient Greece, was it? It's a loving thing. No. I don't think we can make that fly.
No, I don't. I don't think that's a goer, really. That's more of a...
Even for Harris. So I did say, when it's Pete Townsend, you're like, oh, come on. Maybe it's worth sacrificing a few.
No.
I don't mean that. retrograde trigger warning. Sorry. That's quite bad, isn't it?
That was
an offensive joke, which I apologise for. This, on the other hand, is my genuine opinion. Right, in the great rock and roll discography, which is it's a book that you find lying around recording studios, and it's a great big thick sort of Bible of everyone who's ever done anything in rock.
Right? Yeah.
In that book, the kind of, you know, I wouldn't say it was like the authorised history of rock and roll, but it's as close as you can get given that there is no authorised history of rock and roll. Right. Gary Glitter is not in it. Okay. Gary Glitter has been expunged from its pages.
Okay.
Right. Now, as Luke Haynes points out, Goodbye My Love is a hell of a record. And he's not even on it. Yeah. So that should be in there. B, those are some great fucking records Gary Glitter made. Like, but, you know, many Renaissance artists, we're still looking at their paintings, aren't we?
Well, it's the shift in morality, the shift in what we allow. And popular culture is always... Well, there are two ways of looking at it. Ancient Greek popular culture is basically pornographic paintings on pottery.
Absolutely.
You know, and we like this because it's ancient.
Yeah.
But, like, Gary Glitter's just too recent for anyone
it's not
to...
not that recent.
Definition of recent.
I used
here.
To go to.
There are living.
When I was 15, I used to go to fancy dress parties as Gary Glitter. There's pictures of me doing the look and everything. But the thing, you can find, because I'm
I'm in this little sparkly purple shirt on.
It's fucking amazing. Yeah. I look brilliant. Now I can't show it to you. It's terrible. Yeah. The bastard. That's the real crime.
your own fame and fortune.
But no, I'm a member. Well, I'm not a member, but I like to watch this Facebook group. My favourite group on Facebook, which is I think it's called Remember Him This Way, which is a Gary Glitter fan page where they just sort of post. But like, you watch some of those videos. Oh, my God, that man, you might have put a show on.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
There's one where he's like, he's on. I think it's The Last Resort, the Jonathan Ross show, and like, because he was mates with all of them until it happened. And he's there, and he's doing the thing, and he's suddenly in the middle of the interview, just goes, "Oh, yeah." And Jonathan Ross is like, "What?" And he goes, "Adio, and he's like, "Okay," and he goes, "Adio, and then like sort of points at the audience in his Gary Glitter way, and then he's like, "Adio, so he, from the interview, then stands up, does the duck thing, carries on with this, and then goes straight into the live performance, but starts in the chair.
Okay,
it's fucking brilliant. And like,
that is pretty amazing.
I mean, it's the total command of you know. I imagine he shouldn't have used that for evil, but like." <it's> like But yeah, but you know, it's a shame. But anyway, the point is, right, so he has been expunged from the great rock and roll discography. Now, Pete Townsend also has a conviction for that, and he's in it. So are a whole bunch of other people who are, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, I think.
I mean, Pete Townsend should be expunged from the rock and roll discography anyway.
No, he shouldn't. Not true. Pete Townsend's brilliant. What?
Well, I mean, alright, crimes against music since 1980 or something.
Okay. Yeah. Trying to think what's he done much since 1980.
I don't know. There's the whole Who revival, who's best, whatever it's called. That sort of, which was just shockingly.
Yeah.
Bad.
You betty. Yeah. That's the only real like main hit without Keith Moon on drums, isn't it?
Yeah. Just but awful.
But yeah, but still, I mean, because I've been watching lots of stuff about Lifehouse being a fan of doomed concept album projects.
Okay.
Like the whole Lifehouse thing where it was. what he was actually intending to. Did you know about all that?
No.
Well, because the idea was that the idea was that the follow-up to Tommy was going to be this musical about a world where everyone lived in a box where they just had experiences pumped into their brains.
Okay.
And but one note, there was like one pure perfect note of guitar rock that was able to save humanity, right? And I don't know, but like so there was a messiah figure, right? And it was they all go to London, and then everyone, all the kids, like they break out of their boxes, yeah, and they go down to London to find the true messiah of rock and roll who's going to break out. And then they find the one pure note. But then he went mental and thought, oh, you know what? Instead of making a musical about it, I should just actually do that. And so he just took over the Young Vic for about a month and got in loads of people to find the one pure note that actually would save mankind. And apparently it only didn't happen because everyone kept going out to get chips. But I think that's a beautiful, doomed, wondrously stupid story.
Yeah, it's wonderful. I don't know. Fucking rock and roll, man.
Play us a song, B.
A song? Well, it's not exactly a song.
Well, play us something.
I'll play you something. I'll do you something. I think it's probably more correct. So, my current project is
in this. French, that wouldn't have been a problem. Same word, isn't it?
What? Fair.
Do and make and play are all fair.
Yeah, it's kind of the German thing as well, isn't it? It's Machen.
Yeah.
But, so this thing that I've had that I've not been doing called The Bridge, which is...
I should apologise for you. I'm sorry, I'm not very good at running podcasts with guests, and I keep interrupting them when they're... I've done it again to apologise, but I should have interrupted you when you were explaining... should have been asking you leading questions.
No, that. Don't ask me leading questions. Okay. That's really hard. I just get confused.
I'm just going to shut up now.
That's cool. Right, so, yeah. So, anyway, so this is the new thing, and this is an experimental version of the new thing, because the thing itself will develop, because these things always do, and each time I do it live it'll be different, because that's how it works, and eventually it'll be something that's actually recorded and exists. But it's called The Bridge, and it's nearly two sides of a poem prose thing with backing music. It's the FARQ basically, which is this ritual music project I try and do. Are we good?
A bit concerned that sitting on the amp, Julia, has knocked things.
Okay. I don't think so.
You turned on the tape echo.
Had I?
Oh, wow. Which could have been interesting, but I've turned it off now, so I think you're all right.
Okay, so, let's, I'll die. So this is, this. I'm not going to do it all because it's quite long. So I'll do to a point where
I think. If you like.
I don't.
They can skip it.
Yeah, but it's also, I don't have. Like, the music would be... the music.
But if they do, I'm going to put a virus in it, or no.
Yeah.
I don't know how to do it.
No, clearly not. I don't think anyone does. The music I have set to back it is not enough into my taste. Because it has distinct parts, and it would be better. So I'll kind of edit it,
cool,
in a sense. The Bridge. Yeah. Take to the bridge. Break up. Break down like a sick machine. Break up, break down like a sick machine. The bridge is dream state. The bridge is dream state. Art, dark and hideous. The word vulgar. We mix death with mud to make it stick. Word is nothing, not even shibboleth. We have no key and no lock. We look for the absence of door. Drenched in obvious, I am the fool stench. Small marks, little lines of close disguise. A new ferocity. Hunger is not appetite. The ghost of Hannah Foe walked through Kreuzberg today, although she is not dead. Although she is not dead. The ghost of Hannah Foe walked through Kreuzberg today, although she is not dead. Although she is not dead. At day's end, they gather. Day's end, they gather. Febrile figures. Forms reforming. The indistinct edging raises sparks, sharpens tools, hardens armour, hardens ardour. The light must go out. The sun thinks it can live forever. The leaves heard the truth on the breeze, earthbound, clustering around the feet of pillars. One long, perfect knife wound, bright light boundary. I will see with no eyes, a face lit on a computer screen, a dream of glowing beauty stripped of life. He took the darkness, he held it, he doesn't know how to let it go. These are my eyes in the face of death. If the truth is that I am a cunt, it is only this which allows me to recognise other cunts so effectively. The bind is inevitable. Muscle, flesh, nerve, skin, no morality but being. The bridge becomes force and form of this contact, this contract. We are dragged together, bound to conspire. And we would know you if we could, where no means fuck. Cold and wet, sticky with sweat, the stench of cat piss. The speed always does this. He processes olfactory information the best he can by reading molecular forms as visions and sensations, pricking fingers and muscle twinges. He breathes through a straw. It's keeping him alive in this grave, in this darkness, fetid reek of piss and shit. The itching becomes hyper-awareness. Everything is close. Shades, TV images, a truth told in replay, slowed, rewound, the wound reopens, reopens. Here we meet, here we cross, here we leap, here, here. Something like that.
Yay!
Awesome.
Yeah, brilliant.
It's, yeah.
I really like that.
That's fantastic.
I don't think you've got anything to,
Oh, I mean, it's like, it's the, yeah, mixes and levels and the voice, not like the idea, like always with my stuff at the moment, is to have at least three different tracks with the voice on. So one is the, like, the voice natural or as near to natural, maybe with a tiny bit of reverb, yeah. And then one is essentially a complete effects set which is constantly running at an irregular programmed sequence so that it generates this its own rhythm, and then the other is a variable delay which allows me to basically to spread the sound and bring it back and create other rhythms, and then that would then blend much more readily with the racket.
Yeah. But, it sounds great to me.
You do this in clubs, don't you?
I do it in, I mean, I perform it as, like, I try and do it wherever. I do it wherever anyone will let me, as a rule.
I'd let you if I ran a club night still.
Yeah, well, no, I mean, it's a bit weird. I haven't done a gig since, God, for a while now. Partly due to other obligations and partly due to just kind of this being, sitting on this and kind of doing, trying to teach myself more of the skills of the instrument, as it were, which we're not going to call it. It's not a musical instrument. But
listening to something the other day, was going on about the idea that, I think it was probably something really standard and normal, like I think it was at Radiolab or something.
Yeah.
They were talking about how the current thing in music, and I was trying to work out if I think this is true, but a current cutting edge of music is finding what computers have given people. Like, I'm so right, start with that again. That computers have sort of shown the way, and now people are doing with organic things what they'd not considered possible before computers showed them how to do it.
Yes.
So, like, you'll hear, like, I think their examples were then very lame. So they were kind of like, oh, there's this bloke on beat doing beatbox that's like of like extremely cut up, 16th beat dubstep and stuff, but the guy's beatboxing it organically. But he would never have occurred to him to do that if he hadn't put it all through a process in the first place. So I suppose what I'm asking you is, do you think that what you're doing with electronic effects or something is something that eventually you'd like to see a whole bunch of musicians play on, like cellos and stuff? Would that be possible?
Could it's the possibility of recreating the tonal information with live instruments. I think would be possible, but it's like,
would it be cool?
It would be funny.
Yeah.
but I don't know if I don't. I mean, it's like, you know, I mean, the music that I love, that, I mean, specifically, I suppose, mm-hmm. when I like Coil, Psychic TV, Throbbing yeah. Gristle, and Hafler Trio, have all done this kind of thing where they've taken, you know, a sort of some form or other and then taken it backwards, as it were. So, you know.
What Time Is Love? We did it with Acid Brass, wasn't it? Acid Brass.
Yeah.
I love the Acid Brass thing.
But the thing about the Acid Brass is it's not as pumping as the original. And I think what you. I think that one of the main things, and certainly I get out of, like, beats on dance yeah. music, is that when you dance to it, whether you're on drugs or not, you enjoy the symmetry and the perfection of everything being in time to the grid.
I suppose the point of the Acid Brass was similar to this bridging thing, is it was like two working class art forms of the same town, and but the yeah. divide between
yeah.
the kids and their parents, and then finding the common ground of playing like the yeah. KLF on a
yeah. No,
I mean I thought that, I don't know, I just thought it was cool. Do you like that?
I
did a bit of a face before. So.
Well, no, it's weird because I do like it, but it doesn't do. It is it, in the sense it doesn't successfully do the thing itself. As it doesn't, like, you can't, like.
I've seen a video of, like, I think it's somewhere, some, like, Canada or somewhere, but, like, it's clearly very much an arty concert hall sort of yeah. space, and all these sort of very buttoned-up people sitting with their programmes watching Jeremy Deller conduct Acid Brass.
Yeah.
And then, about halfway through, they start trying to do, like, club dancing, these people in there, like, it's sort of amazing. Because they're really, you know, they're really bad at it. But again, being really bad at dancing and doing it anyway is kind of the point in the first place. Yeah. And so you'll see these people who, you know, so obviously they're not, what they're not getting is that euphoric, like, buzz out of the feeling the bass kick yeah. through their body. But they are, something in it yeah. is forcing them out of their seats and making them make total tits of themselves. And I don't know, so it almost is getting towards something.
Yeah, I mean, well, I mean that's going back or towards the, you know. Rich music as ritual,
yeah.
Or, you know, music not as a passive form,
because
that's the. I mean, the thing I love about dance music is that it's that essentially it's a relationship. It's, you know, whereas a lot of the way music is represented is, you know, with this seated concept. You know, I mean, going to gigs where you have to sit is a horrific experience. It's like,
well, now they've got little signs up saying please do not speak during. The Lumineers have that little signs up everywhere going, please do not speak during the performances, for God's sake, you animals. It's like, I hate playing there just for that. It's like, oh, fuck off, be
if
better.
You can't, if you can't get people, I don't know. I think you have to be able to get them, otherwise it's kind of, you know.
Well, I mean, it's also, you know, people go to gigs for a variety of reasons, and, you know, if they're not into you, they're just not into you, and that's fair enough, and it's just like, you deal with it.
I miss going, because I don't really like going to gigs. I'm never going to. It's not something I enjoy. I'll only enjoy it if it's, I don't know, fast and has a beat, really. Because the thing I used to like about going out dancing was that I'd go on my own. I didn't really hook up with anybody or anything. I might know some people there, but I didn't.
Yeah.
I didn't. It wasn't about hooking up with anybody. You didn't do that. You went to dance.
Yeah.
And take drugs or whatever, but it didn't matter, and no one else there was, you know, having relationships or anything. No. It was you're going to be, I don't know, however ridiculous it sounds, you were going to dance around to music that made you dance around. You got from it what you needed, and it gave it to you, and that was all that mattered, really. And that, like,
yeah, that, well, I mean, I do that. I still, I mean, I, you know, I go to clubs in Berlin, and I will, like, basically I'll go on my own. I will barely speak to anyone. I will
and then
dance
you'll go
for,
home and you'll cry and you'll want to die.
Well, no, I'll dance for 4 or 5 hours on caffeinated fucking fizzy drinks, and get completely wired and high on this caffeine, and then go home. And it's like, and having essentially released a whole lot of energy, because an experience, you know, I mean, in some cases, some beautiful, lovely fucking acid techno, and you're just like, and it's just like, yeah, right, no, I'm there. It's like,
and it doesn't matter if you can't dance, or nobody's watching you, and it's,
well, it's just, it doesn't,
it's kind of a private affair, really. It's not, well, really, anyone's business.
I think that's what that Phil Collins song is about. How his love of acid techno and psytrance.
What song is that?
I Can't Dance.
Yeah, I don't know. Did you? There was a hardcore tune by Project One that had a young girl taking the piss out of the I Can't Dance. I can't dance. I can't sing. No, I didn't think they had that. Basically, but over this, like, but like really nicely done over this break beat with this lovely bass, and it's just like, yeah, cool,
awesome.
Yeah, because that is an awful song, and Phil Collins should be shot.
Yeah, yeah, obviously. I mean, like, I think that's clear. But I'm just thinking maybe there's a hidden depth to do with his nights at the Hacienda. And
yeah, the fact that he wasn't taking any E, which made him self-conscious.
Yeah. And he was sitting there, they go, he's not on E, he's in the Hacienda, Phil Collins, in 1988. He's going, oh, I feel really self-conscious. I'm just not down with it. And I tried Flesh, but it just wasn't doing it for me. So I've come to this sort of more standard night. And Nah. Don't like it, Governor. No.
So I've got my list of questions that are increasingly long now.
Okay, no good. No, we have to.
So, but I keep asking this one just because I think it results in an interesting answer.
Okay,
which is
it did once.
That's more than a few times.
Would you say you are fully committed to an alternative lifestyle, or do you like some aspects of the mainstream?
Do I like aspects of the mainstream? No. Am I fully committed? No. I've taken to describe myself as a dilettante because I'm really crap at being an activist. I was quite good at being a hedonist for a while, but you know, currently I have a job.
Yeah.
And that in itself means that I am not fully committed because I'm employed by someone. And that, you know, that's kind of horrific. But at the same time, it means that I'm not starving and other things. So it's kind of weird. But no, I don't. I hate the mainstream. Like, the mainstream culture, almost everything about it upsets me. Work, freaking politics, politicians, blah, 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 blah. It's all evil.
I see.
That hasn't really changed. It doesn't ever change. I think
people don't hate work enough. It's really this whole generation.
Yeah,
you're getting out.
Because I think there's lots of things that me and Simon probably disagree with you about, and that you disagree with us. But I don't think that that's ever really been a problem because there are some fundamental things that we
fundamentally
agree on.
Work,
which
is a bad thing and should not be encouraged.
The idea that work in itself is something that is really desperately important, and I don't get it. It's like it's such a, and it seems to be very much a generational thing at the moment. Like it's really important that I have a career, and you're like, why is this so important to you?
Yeah, but that's, I mean,
it was only ever something you were supposed to do to kind of get money so you could do what you were supposed to be doing in
maybe that,
and even then avoid it if possible, you know. But
yeah, there's been a shift in.
I mean, I don't know whether I use that argument because I am too cowardly to get a job that I'm qualified for.
No, I don't think so. I think it was always true that, like, most people I liked kind of sort of treated work as something. So, no, not work, not the idea of effort and labour.
Yeah.
But I always think it's like, I don't know, because I don't use the same terms, but I always thought of labour as being something that one, when one labours at something, it's kind of biblical and is a different thing. But work is just something where you.
A job. Employment.
Yeah.
Working for someone else in such a way as to be, you know, paid, but at the same time a wage slave. I mean,
but when you work with people who are just doing it for some cash flow, and they pick the job that has the least amount of responsibility and stuff, quite often you are meeting people who have the same perspective on work as you do, and I think people have forgotten that. They kind of think, oh, I don't have anything in common with them, and you're like, you're crazy. You have loads in common with them. They have just decided not to take a 9-to-5 job that has absolutely no meaning, and instead do a job that, you know, that they do something with their labour, and then they get paid for it. And because, you know, the idea of doing anything else is actually unbearable to them.
No, I mean it's a lot of people I work with in Berlin that they all have other lives. I mean, that's the thing. They have other lives. I think part of the work thing comes from affordability of accommodation. People affording accommodation now are in way, like, it, you know, you could, it's far harder in the UK to afford accommodation than it used to be, or certainly in the South. I don't know about the North, I haven't been there for a while. You know, and that makes a massive difference. And, you know, also the persecution of the unemployed, which is horrific, and you know, the most the
and expensive.
Well, just ludicrous. Just the idea that being unemployed is somehow wrong, you know, this idea that you should be actively seeking work, all this kind of stuff that is just completely and utterly false.
It seems to exist. Me and Simon talked about this before. It seems to exist because other people think it's terribly important. Rather than, I still don't know why the living wage isn't something that people consider an option, because supposedly that would save.
Don't mean the living wage. You mean the citizens' income.
Citizens' income.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. The D-linker. Yeah, that's one of their policies, isn't it? Yeah. The whole, you know, give people an amount of money that they can actually live on.
Well, the thing is, you can pretty much pay for that in what you currently use to investigate benefit fraud. But I mean, that's it's kind of in terms, and it makes sense economically even if you're a laissez-faire libertarian, which I find I am sometimes, depending on the day. That allows people to spend money. I think what's really the main argument against it was that if you give people an income, they then won't do anything, which is kind of, I find, just staggeringly stupid and offensive.
Everybody
want money.
Does.
And if they don't, it doesn't matter. But, you know, on the whole.
Yeah, well, I mean, the majority of work that's done is unnecessary.
Absolutely.
You know, the work that needs to be done is, people will do. People don't like, most people do not like being idle. I mean, I find myself relatively special in that I actually do like being idle. I'm quite good at it. But most people I know...
You're the best I know.
Most people I know find being idle for any length of time actually difficult and would much rather be doing something.
Yeah, definitely.
You know, and so if they didn't have to do a shit job to pay the fucking rent and feed themselves, they could do something that was actually valuable to them and by definition therefore would produce value.
Mm. Well, it does. I mean, that's it. I think there's this weird thing with where people are unable to see the difference between value and money, and that money is not really... I don't go along with this, money's just a fiction, because, you know, so is everything if you think about it like that. It's kind of stupid, it's a kind of childish thing to say. But at the same time, money is not value.
No.
And there's immense value in anything that's created, and the adding of value is then represented in money. But yeah, if you're sitting at home and your rent and food is paid for, the amount of value you can, even in a completely capitalist system, if you have total laissez-faire capitalism with that one modification of a citizen's income from the state, then, you know, to me that ends up in a vastly better. What I find is weird with the current generation is they seem to think that they're looking for like a sort of unified whole fulfilment, but they think that's the thing they'll get from a job. And the ones I really like will believe that. They'll sort of go, I'm not that old, but growing up in the 90s, everyone knew there was like the day job, which was never going to be fulfilling, was always going to be shit no matter what it was.
Yeah.
And then there was what you really wanted to do or not. But if you were going to be fulfilled, you'd never go looking for fulfillment in a paycheck from someone else. You'd never go, I really want a job that I'm going to love and then be fulfilled every day. It just was never even a consideration, because the fact that you're dependent on someone else's paycheck fundamentally excludes that possibility to me.
Yeah.
But now, I talk to the young people today and they genuinely seem to think, well, what I'm looking for is a job that will leave me feeling fulfilled every day. I said, well, you're not going to find that, because it fundamentally will be a whore.
Also, jobs that directly are designed for people who've done their particular degree, and you're like, really? That's you will not find a job unless it's exactly that, in which case why don't you do something else? Do something else.
Isn't that much demand in this capitalist system for extensive essays about what happened in EastEnders? I don't think it's not.
It's kind of the, I don't know what am I trying to say, I've forgotten. People looking for work, looking for this fulfillment thing. Mm. It seems to have come out of the post-millennial culture, maybe. I don't know. I met some fucking ad exec column in The Guardian for a while. I can't remember who it was.
Right.
And it was all these sort of half truisms where, you know, you have to do this to do that kind of bollocks. You know
what I mean?
And the idea that you could, this self-fulfillment through work process, which it seems to me, without wanting to diss the Americans, a very American way of thinking, it's part of the American dream, isn't it? That you get.
I don't know if it is. I don't know if it is. Well, to me, the American dream is.
Well, I think of Death of a Salesman as the anti-American dream, and in that, I mean, I know that's an old American dream, but you know, it seems that that is still the thing. You know, his fulfillment is because he is a good salesman, and that is his, you know, his raison d'être. And then when he's not a good salesman, when basically it all falls apart, that is he's like his dream falls apart, and you know, and that metaphor stands.
To me, I just see the American dream as a hoped for guarantee of total social mobility, which obviously isn't true for certain races, but you know, just like
invite certain classes,
but less so for certain classes. I mean, it's not kind of because fundamentally the point is, if you were to walk into the Oval Office as president talking like a steel worker from Pittsburgh, no one would go, well, you can't be here, you've got the wrong voice. I mean, that's fundamentally the difference.
Yeah,
I mean, like, you know, and obviously there are huge, and there will always be huge class structures, and definitely huge racial structures that kind of prevent that. But like, in terms of what the dream is,
I
think the striving towards that dream is probably a good thing. I don't have a
I mean, in terms of the idea of social mobility is, you know, if you're going to have a socially strata system, probably a good thing. It would be surely better to destroy the socially strata system, but that's...
Well, I mean, as long as everyone's equally rich.
Yeah,
well, as long as we don't have this equally poor shit. If everyone's equally rich, I'm for it.
Yeah, well...
But I would prefer the basic standard of living to keep going up. And,
yeah,
and
well, not, I think...
That's to me the main thing.
I think that's an issue, though, isn't it? I mean, the gap... I would like to bring the gap down. I don't think that, you
They're
know...
They're not that bad. They've got some nice khakis in the gap. I mean, in the gap.
Yeah, very funny.
Yeah.
Do you me and Simon were talking about this the other day, and I'm not sure I know the answer to it. Do you think that because people who went out in the 90s and danced a lot and took pills and then had children, do you think their children are like this because they were all loved up and stuff?
They were raised by hedonists.
Yeah. Do you think that all this kind of need for hugging and
cut
kind
cakes.
Of yeah kind of gentleness kind of, but like mainstreamed kind of gentleness is sort of without any shame at all, without any sense of things being private and everything being very emotional is kind of what I mean, over emotional. Do you think that's
cupcakes
because
the logical endpoint of rave culture?
Yeah,
one would hope
is
not
Simon's
but quite possibly
thing.
Yeah,
and the same really, that was my favourite tweet of the week was Italy Bullet saying about that tiger milk led to Keep Calm and Carry On in the same way that the Futurist Manifesto led to the March of the Iron Will. Wasn't that interesting? it's absolutely true. But maybe it goes back. Maybe it's the rave culture that's kind of given birth
so
to a three generation because their parents were too fucking happy.
Yeah.
Well, possibly. Or just you have like the idea that, you know, particularly English people, emotionally stunted, suddenly emotionally freed, and that, like, so the idea of emotional freedom is new to a large part of the population. And it's suddenly like, okay, we can touch one another without it being sexual.
Mm.
Yeah,
you know, this is really unusual. You know, the continent have been doing this for years.
It's all gone back. It's all gone back.
I remember being
at
school and suddenly all the girls started to hug each other.
Yeah.
In between classes, you know, they hadn't seen each other for an hour, and they'd all hug each other, and you'd be like, "What the fuck?"
And then that princess died.
Yeah, this
I think that's when it turned.
That has a lot to do with it, I reckon.
Yeah,
that was very weird. And
very public.
Yeah, the public grief. Where the fuck did that come from?
Yeah,
I mean, I went over to the Kensington during that week to just basically to see the crowd, and as far as I could tell, the vast majority of that crowd was there to see the crowd.
Yeah,
they weren't there because out of it. I mean, I just don't buy this. There was a huge outpouring. It wasn't. People had heard there was a crowd. There were some nutters who started it off, and then people went, "Oh shit, I better take some flowers so I don't look out of place." And I'm sure it was almost entirely a self-reflect. I just don't quite buy it.
Well, I don't know, but you did that weird thing where you talk to people and they'd be like, "But she was a member of the royal family. It was basically a privileged piece of shit and blah.
And fuck her.
Yeah.
But like, you know, the first thing that I found out, my mum came and told me when I was waking up in bed, and then I got a phone call from my friend William, who's like really the opposite of you. He's an arch establishment, I think he's either Catholic or quite high church of England. Mm. very conservative, right? It's been the Conservative Party always, and it's always that, you know, very, very, very clever. And it's just kind of, it's always one of these interesting things that, like, one of the cleverest people I know has come to almost opposite conclusions than some of the other cleverest people I know. But he's always had a bit of a thing about restoring the Stuarts. And he's
like, you do,
yeah. He just phoned me up and said, "The bitch is dead." That was like the first bit of comment I heard on that.
That's got. He was delighted. He was thrilled. She was dead. Somewhere,
but there is something. The conspiracy theory is that she was a Stuart, and that was why she was seen off, because you could trace back the Spencer lineage back to the Stuarts, and obviously the current royal family has no real claim to the throne anyway, because they're not Stuarts. And there was this sort of Jacobite idea that she would come back, and so her son would then be. And I think it was that to do with that, and then pollution of the Stuart line, and therefore the Merovingian line with this Arab seed was supposed to be occurring. And that's why the Pont de l'Alma is an ancient Merovingian sacrificial mound, and that's why she was done there. It's an extensive. I think people have given up on it. Like, just a piss bloke crashed a car. But, like, you know,
it's the moon goddess. It's the sacrifice. It's so many things.
Called Diana. I mean, like,
there are so many things in that way. You know, Elvis. We have Elvis is the Pan Dionysus, and it, you know, and you have.
Yeah,
but totally was.
I mean, where is the New Age of Aquarius?
Where is the New Age of Aquarius? The New Age of Aquarius died with Elvis.
Right, oh, I see. So that was wasn't like a ritual sacrifice of the Pan, that was the ending of the Pan.
Yeah.
I see.
You know, there's the beginning of the, like, neoconservative era.
Yeah. Interesting. So, but what is the... So, is there a name for the age that comes after the Age of Aquarius?
The Age of Shit.
And a cool, like, Egyptian name. Like, which is like...
A cool Egyptian name.
Well, you know, so we've got Isis, Osiris, Horus. What comes next?
Oh.
Isis and Osiris give birth to the Age of Horus. No, it's got to be an actual Egyptian.
Oh, okay. Like, I just thought, because he said
Thoth, isn't it? I don't know if it's Thoth.
Is it Thoth that comes next? I do have the Book of Lies, but it's quite hard to make sense out of.
Yeah, the Book of Lies is not really sense.
No.
I mean, well, it's hypersense, isn't it?
Chapter 69 makes sense.
It's sense in the...
Chapter 69 is called The Way to Succeed. It's very good, that, isn't it? It's a joke. It's a oral sex pun.
Chapter, I figured it was going to be
the way to succeed
chapter.
And the way to suck eggs, but suck seed. And yeah. Alistair Crowley, just basically music hall magic.
Now then,
the way to succeed. Have you seen that thing in Blackpool they've got now where they've got all the music hall like jokes on the floor and a big
I have
arty
been,
thing? It's
not good. Been to Blackpool for a very long time.
We went. I'd never been, so we went back on the way back from Scotland.
Me too.
Are we going to do any more songs?
I don't know.
Do you want to do a ne'er-do-well song? I mean, I was just thinking we could play like one note on the piano and the guitar, and you could.
Yeah, well, we could. I mean, it's
that
the
could
thing,
work. Yeah,
is the thing still working? Because we could do Never Enough, which is very short, and basically,
I do like that one.
It goes like.
Well, if you say how it goes, you've done it.
Well, no, I don't mean the words, but you know, I mean, like it basically goes. Do I get the rhythm? Hang on, let me get the rhythm. Just. I don't want to. I probably did want to say that.
Isn't that?
Yeah, I think so.
That's probably basically a bit false.
No, it is. It's when I used to do it, it's very quickly. Okay.
The ne'er-do-wells, just to talk while you're looking, that was Bee's band that he was in. It was you and Rin and Helen.
Yeah, the singer, the drummer, and the
bassist. I was looking for it on corporate records, but alas, it is
but
not
someone
on corporate records.
Bothered to put it on there.
No,
so.
No, I haven't finished.
Is on corporate records.
Yeah, I haven't finished.
Have you got any vinyls left?
I don't think, but PC probably does. I want to actually, because I still essentially owe the man cash. I would like to probably get them, and because I can probably sell them somewhere.
Yeah, it's a really cool record. I love that single.
Yeah,
I love the thing you did with Edwin.
Yeah,
it was such a collision, but like it was a beautiful collision. It was sort of,
well, I mean, it was more Edwin than me.
No, it wasn't, because it's this unedited vocal take, which is fucking amazing. You
yeah,
and like it's one of the, it's up there with Starships by Nicki Minaj, as far as I'm concerned.
It was great vocal performance.
Yeah, and but then with Edwin's sort of hyper produced
trance
underneath, it was awesome. I love that. That should be on Corporate Records.
All right,
but no, it's not.
Well, with regards to the rest of the Nerdaworld catalogue, you're gonna have to wait.
Make a really obvious edit and do it in the middle of a word or something.
Yeah.
Not enough intelligence, not enough irony, not enough clever words, never enough, never enough, never enough, never enough, not enough sex, not enough chords, not enough music, never enough, never enough, never enough, never enough, not enough instruments, not enough musicians, not enough audience, never enough, never enough, never enough, never enough, not enough irony, not enough intelligence, not enough clever words, never enough, never enough, never enough, never enough, not enough sex, not enough chords, not enough music, never enough, never enough, never enough, never enough. Not enough instruments, not enough musicians, not enough audience, never enough, never enough, never enough, never enough!
Very good.
Awesome. Oh, I loved the Ne'er-do-wells. I remember when you just did a whole song about how we were shit when you supported us.
Yeah.
One of my favourite things that's ever happened. People were genuinely concerned about us. Like, it's a bit harsh. Oh, no, that was amazing. Idiot.
Yeah, well, you know, I love Stuart Home, and at the end of the day, that was completely Stuart Home inspired.
Unnecessary, I think.
Yeah, well, I was going to ask you about Stuart Home, but we have run out of time.
I
follow him on
say
Twitter.
Something you like about Stuart Home, because defend Stuart Home against John Seagrave in the past.
How can I defend
on a podcast that you've not heard? John Seagrave says that he doesn't really go in for the novels, but he does like the criticism. But I'm trying to remember exactly what he said, but he thought the novels were a bit indulgent.
Well, I don't know. See, to me, Stuart Home is all about performance, really. I mean, his novels are performance in the sense of that, I think, at least in part. You know, like the fact that Down and Out in Shortest and Hoxton is written in paragraphs of exactly 100 words.
Yeah.
So it creates this unnatural rhythm as you read it. And then, you know, I just think it's the best.
You know what? Don't defend him. Go and buy a Stuart Home book and see what you think.
No, I don't.
That's what I think. But before you do that, how can people give you money in exchange for things?
They can. They can still theoretically buy the original Ne'er-do-wells single, probably from
Sad Gnome Records,
assuming they still have
technically
some way.
They no longer exist.
Yeah, but I don't know if they still sell.
You could probably contact Per Christian from there, though.
Yeah. And
on the Far Queue.
The Far Queue mostly is available on Corporate.
I can give you the address exactly if you like. If you just go to corpor.at and /R106.
106.
106.
That is the Far Queue, and excellent stuff there.
Loads of stuff there.
Yeah, it's all brilliant as well. And is there anything of ours we need to talk about? You should go and buy the Dirty North album while that's out. Though obviously that'll have been out for a while by the time you hear this. But
yeah, it's on Corporate Records. It's great. We've been talking about them for a long time.
Eons.
We have. Yeah. Finally,
it was the second Ice Age, and
great band.
Finally released an album. Okay, so give them some money for that. By now, we'll have probably released our one, so there's no point talking about that because you'll know about it already.
Yeah.
What date? It'll probably be October now. In so yeah, I hope enjoy the mists and mellow fruitfulness, and Halloween and pumpkins and stuff. Enjoy that. It's really fucking hot today. It's like the hottest September I've ever.
Yeah.
So it doesn't feel very October-y.
No, not at all.
But if we've been too sunny in our disposition on this podcast, we apologise for giving you that kind of seasonal dissonance that you probably hadn't expected. But that is it. Goodbye from me, Simon Indelicate.
Goodbye from me, Julia Indelicate.
From, is it B23 still?
Mostly.
Yeah, it's B23. Goodbye from him. And that's our podcast. Thank you very much.